Hey, oh, and here we go. It's WTC. We Talk Comics, episode number 44, on the air and in your ear. This is going to be a great one, guys, because it is our one-year anniversary. And so we're going to go around the room, of course, and we're going to get the guys to introduce their favorite memory of this last year, starting with my buddy Brett.
Well, Mo, my favorite memory of this year, I would have to say, came in the zero, in our zero episode, where everybody spit out the books that they hadn't read, the guilty pleasures, like just the guilty not having read things, and I found that one really engaging. Plus, it also kind of forced me into reading many of those series that I haven't read, and frankly, I've enjoyed them a great deal, so it's added a lot to my comic reading.
I hated that show because it exposed a lot of books that I haven't read. And by the way, if we do a second zero, a point one, and ask if I've read them, so far, Chris, what's your favorite memory of the last year on the show?
Peter freaking David. I wasn't there for the interview. He's one of my favorite comic writers. And when I got the text that you guys got to spend an hour with Peter David, just listening to him talk, asked him a couple questions, and recorded his entire thing at the Comic-Con, I was so jealous. Yet the interview lived up to everything I wanted. You guys really got all the questions I needed answered from Peter David. And the fact that he isn't two people, I am kind of relieved.
Keith, your favorite memory of last year, my friend?
Well, if I put aside all of the times we've spent with the Mulvey, I got to say the Malibu retrospective episode that Mo and I got to chat with and get the inside scoop from two of the founders of Malibu Comics. And probably the very specific moment was when they started telling us about how they were almost bought up by DC Comics. And Mo turned to me and just lipped the words, "Do you have any idea that this had happened?" I'm like, "I have no idea. Let them talk."
That was a great moment. I remember exactly the look in your face. Looking at you going, yeah, that, you know what? There's been a lot of great stuff. Like you say, hooking up with people, hooking up with you guys regularly, talking comics. Getting my comics mojo even more going, you know, and all the people we've met that we didn't know who we forged relationship with, that's definitely valuable to me. But my favorite moment was simply the con stories, the funny con stories, telling our funniest con stories. Keith telling his story of flashing his legs at Larry Hama and being ignored. Chris telling Dan Barretton that he wrote something he didn't and arguing with Emma on it, stuff like that. That is the funniest episode for me. That's been the highlight of the last year. That just ruled. So, all right, I'm Mo, by the way. We're going to get on with it. This one's called We Talk Comics. Has it covered? Reason why is because we're going to be talking a lot about covers, what makes good covers, favorite covers, kind of analyzing it a little bit. We're going to get into that a little bit and have some fun. And, of course, we have a whole ton of Wii views to get to. But first off, we got something even more interesting. You guys are watching the Olympics, of course. The Olympics on TV, boring as hell. Personally, can't stand it. You want some good Olympic action? You got to hit our friend Comicosity, the sponsor of our news. Comicosity's got daily Olympic events with superheroes and villains. It's cool as hell, timely as hell, fun as hell. You gotta check that out along with their reviews, including some written by Keith and Brett, and of course their previews, all the news, everything laid out in the classiest, easiest to navigate manner possible by the best man in comics, our buddy Aaron Long, aka Juice005 on Twitter. So visit Comicosity. And now, the weekly news, Cup Reporter K.
Well, we are getting a ton of creator shakeups happening, particularly at Marvel. As well as all the Marvel Now stuff, which we'll get into in just a minute, Greg Rucka has said that when his run of Punisher ends, he will be leaving monthly superhero books. He wants to focus on creator-owned, so he's got the end of the Punisher run currently, and a 4 or 5 issue mini, and that's going to be it for him. He'll be moving,
Whiteout?
Moving on. One can hope that he would go back to do a third volume of Whiteout. That'd be quite fun. But yeah, that's where he's heading. I've really enjoyed his Punisher run, so I'm kind of sad to see that go. But
Yeah, this is the first one of these announcements that I'm unsure of, because Rekka is still producing quality work in the superhero field.
And he hasn't really been with Marvel that long after being with DC for ages.
No, it's only been a little over a year. So yeah, it'll only be maybe a 20-issue run by the end. I guess that's enough to make a handsome omnibus by the end.
Yeah, something at least.
With this mass exodus from the major character from superheroes, do you guys think maybe that we have an Image type situation where they're going to band together in 6 to 8 months?
Actually, something I was thinking about a lot today, as I thought about, I was listening to an interview with Tony Harris and Steve Niles, who are talking about moving away from superhero stuff and not working at DC. And we've got Rekka moving on. We've got a lot of these creators focusing on creator-owned work. I do wonder if it's a bit of a reaction to Before Watchmen. Certainly we've already seen creators that have, in a very public way or in a less public way, walked away from DC because of Before Watchmen, and just the acknowledgement that the reality of work for hire is never going to change. It is what it is, and you can continue to work there, or you can go do your own thing, but you can't stay and complain. So I do wonder about that. Any thoughts from you, Brett?
I don't know specifically whether they'll band together, because I'm not 100% sure that the financial feasibility is available to them. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It wouldn't surprise me to see them, go with the same company. Like, they all might go with Image and that kind of thing, or IDW, but I'm not 100% sure that they start their own company.
What is IDW's publishing philosophy? Can anybody tell me that? I mean, you can see what Dynamite's publishing philosophy is, for instance. Dark Horse, you can see to a large degree. I've never known exactly what IDW's is. It does feel like Image Light.
Well, I think that's what it is, yeah. It's pretty much get what you can and publish.
Not that there isn't good work there then still, but no, is that their philosophy?
Well, and certainly what they've done with packaging on older work, what they've done on Rocketeer with new and old work, what they've done with John Byrne's older work, like Next Men, packaging it, just amazing collections that they've done. And a real focus on the creator work, Mike Grell's John Sable stuff was collected by IDW. So forging those relationships by bringing older work back into print and getting new work out of some of these guys. At the last two or the last three or four John Byrne books were all through IDW.
Now, since Image, there's been many attempts by comic book creators to come together and form their own group, largely writers without the artists in there, and they've all essentially failed. So I can't see why this would be any different if that's their game plan. I just don't know.
Just the names involved. I don't think anyone is as big as Morrison.
I'm not so sure about that, ever Chris. Tried I mean, that. I mean, CrossGen, for instance, had some really big names come together, right?
You can't compare Wade to Morrison. I mean, Grant Morrison was a DC launch 52 writer.
Wade was pretty freaking hot back then.
Oh, yeah. I just think some of these names are so much bigger than anything we've seen together, especially if they were to.
Well, name me a second name that's bigger then.
Sorry?
Name me a second name we're talking about that's bigger then.
Oh. Well, I don't want to say
Brett?
Rekka.
Rekka is not bigger.
No.
Brett, you got one.
Well, no, it's not that I have one bigger name. It's just one of the, but when you talk about big names, one of the things that I think is that the problem with name people when they get out and they band together is that there's almost invariably a disagreement in some way, and so it kind of fractures them, because I think we saw that with Image, and we see that with other people in the industry, and it's just like, and they just have a disagreement, and the next thing you know, they can't work together. And I think a bigger piece of the puzzle is that to start your own company, you need somebody who's willing to focus on the business side and not the creative, really. And I think that that's one of the absolute keys. If you don't have that person who's focusing on the business side,
you need that right person. You need that. Absolutely. You got to have that right person. So we'll see. We'll see. Of course, it's all speculation at this point. Speaking of speculation, Keith's cat, I believe, has something to speculate on it.
Yes, the cat has made herself known. As soon as she knows the tenor of my voice when I start the podcast, that it is time to come hassle me, because I will be sitting in one place for a couple hours.
All right. Get on with the news, damn it.
All right. Well, an update on the Oxymoron Kickstarter, which we talked about on our super special length Mo and Joe show. That Kickstarter has now crossed the $16,000 mark and has opened up its next bonus. It is variant covers, 10 different variant covers. So we're seeing, if you check the Kickstarter, there's 6 of them have been unveiled. And the extra bonus that the book will now be an oversized hardcover.
Yeah, and I just want to say, even though, I mean, obviously we're friends with them, but it's not just that. Even if you just go check it out, look at those variant covers, and tell me you don't want that. Tell me that isn't quality stuff. You know, you're going to see that. You're going to be interested in it. If you're not sure if you want to throw your money beside or you're not sure what the project is, go check that out, because it's really cool stuff they got going.
Absolutely. And now being the oversized, they're going to add about an inch on height and width on this book, and it'll be about the size of what one of the Walking Dead hardcovers is. So it'll be a
happy book. I thought you were going to make a joke about me being fat. We're adding height and width.
It can't be that big.
You don't get taller. That's never known you could get taller.
Just fatter. I'm just used to doing the shows with Addy and We Talk Wrestling. He never would pass up a chance like that. to mention, I don't know if you guys have ever looked at the We Talk Wrestling page, web page. At the very bottom, it says in the border, it says Mo is fat. I discovered that it had already been on there for like 4 months. I discovered that. How long has that been on there? Oh, about 4 months. Oh, great.
I told you we should never let him into the website.
What's that?
I told you we should never let him into the website.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, he's determined. But yeah, it's pretty funny. I told him to leave it. But anyways, go on, Keith. What else you got?
Creator Carl Kiesel is selling his Silver Age comic collection. He's adopting a child who has some medical problems, and to help pay for these bills, he's put his comic collection up for sale, and there is remarkable things. This is being sold through Blast Off Comics. And there is early Spider-Man, there's early Fantastic Four. It is a really impressive collection. And, you know, a great cause. If you happen to have $2,500 for an Amazing Spider-Man number one, or say a sign, and even $25 for a Hulk signed by Harlan Ellison. So, variety of things different price ranges.
You gotta applaud him for doing something like that. That's, That's something else. I hope it turns out well for him.
Me as well. And it is a great reason to put your collection up if you have to. This is the organization.
It's one thing to do it for your own child, but to adopt a child and do it, that makes it even more, that's a very special person there. So.
Absolutely. This is the company that was the dealer for Mark Waid's collection, who liquidated it to pay for his foray into digital comics, is also selling Harlan Ellison's comic collection. So they deal in these larger things, these giant collections. Worth taking a look at Blast Off Comics and seeing if you can help out this good reason and get some really cool Silver Age stuff.
All at the same time, right? All at the same time. All right,
not to slow down the news any further, but Keith, do we know why Harlan Ellison is selling his collection?
It's probably not as good a reason.
All right.
I'm willing to just bet.
I just keep waiting for his death announcement. So I thought maybe since I'd been off the internet for a day and a half, I'd miss something.
Well, Brendan will tell me at the end of the news. That's our tradition. If I have, if someone has passed on and I've forgotten to mention it, Brett will tell me at the end of the news so that it's very clear that I missed it.
Well, and also, when that happens, Chris, expect a text. All right, let's keep going.
All right. Well, we are seeing the early numbers for July sales. No specific unit numbers, but we do know that the top 10 comics were for July. And Walking Dead, as expected, is the number one book of July. The the Avengers vs. X-Men issues 7 and 8 are 2 and 3. Batman and Justice League 4 and 5. Ozymandias 6. AVX Versus. Then Detective Green Lantern in Action to fill out the top 10. This is Walking Dead number 100, which was the biggest first print comic since the Amazing Spider-Man with Barack Obama. So big deal comic.
Big deal comic, and you know what? Especially considering it's an independent book, as I've always said.
You have you were right from the beginning on that, Mo.
I know. As I eat a little crow.
Well, the interesting thing I see in these numbers is that, as I said, Ozymandias is number 6 in the top 10, the number 1 issue, but none of the Before Watchmen number 2s are in the top 10. So,
well, have they come out yet?
Yeah, there were 3 of them.
Did the Rorschach come out yet?
No, Rorschach number 1 is out this month, as is Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah, I know. It seems like they stopped the momentum of rolling them out, and what they were doing stopped. I imagine the creator of Rorschach fell behind, the artist, because he's well known for that.
No, the planned schedule on Before Watchmen is to have only one Before Watchmen book every week, so they won't be quite once a month.
It'll be
staggered so that there's never a week. There's not supposed to be a week that has 2 issues of any Before Watchmen. So there's one book.
It's too bad, because I'm waiting for that Rorschach to come out so we can argue about it.
Absolutely. And, yeah, both of those are out this month. And so there were 3 number 2s in July. And then working some math that, you know, if you
just
figure...
They dropped, huh? They just... People must... What does that say? They dropped that significantly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether that's... We'll ask Chris and Brett on an opinion on that. I mean, doing a bit of math, if Action and Green Lantern were more or less static, there'd be no real reason for them to move more than, you know, 1% or so. Detective would have had some impact because of Court of Owls, but figure those two books are the same. To have dropped from where they were to below Green Lantern and Action, it's probably about a 25% drop, which is... It's not unheard of for a number 2, but it's a pretty significant drop for something that's got this much focus. So maybe Chris?
I'm actually surprised the Comedian dropped, but I'm not terribly surprised about the other books. The other books didn't have as recognizable characters. Everyone's waiting for Rorschach. And, I mean, Silk Spectre, I mean, who cares? I'm reading the book, but sure, I can easily see a 75% sell-through in comparison to one. A 25% drop is to be expected. I'm not surprised at all.
Chris, why is it you're surprised about the Comedian?
The Comedian is one of the characters I related to. I like the Bastard characters. I like Rorschach. I like the Comedian. I kind of thought the Comedian would have a bigger... hardcore draw.
But I'm not sure, just because you like the Bastard characters, that if you look at historically the high-selling guys, I'm not sure the Bastard characters are in the end order most popular.
I just assume when I like a character, everybody else does.
All right. Brett, you got an opinion here?
Well, I think that the number one thing in this case is that so many people went out with the intention of buying the number ones. Whether or not they intended to get everything, I think some people may have intended to get everything, but they kind of realized after the first little while, like, that holy crap, that's going to cost them a lot of money. And so I think people kind of just went on and said, you know, I'll get the number ones, that'll be okay, and then I'll wait. And I definitely think that this, like, for me, I really have no interest in anything but the trades now. I'm not going to read number 2, 3, 4. I'll just read them all together.
And it's no secret, of course, that I wasn't interested in the books at all in the first place, which is why I didn't realize the number 2s had shipped, because, I mean, I just don't care. but, you know, I mean, that said,
it's
I do wonder.
Now.
Yeah, I do wonder, that said, if this is a sense that the retailers as well were frightened about what the backlash might have been from the fans. They knew they'd have the number one sales be strong. But
yeah, but did the retailers would have probably ordered similar numbers to the number ones?
Well, that's the question, though, isn't it? Is did the retailers, or did the retailers immediately assume there would be backlash, and they knew they would be able to move number ones because it was number ones and there'd be curiosity, but expect a lot of backlash from that? And were they getting the backlash within their own books and stores, and did that have anything to do with it? So, and who knows? Who knows, right? We need to talk to an actual few retailers to kind of get their feel on that.
I think that life on the ground, it's probably not that much backlash that a dealer has had to deal with. It would be my guess. But I mean,
they hear things. I'm not saying that nobody's going to come in there and go, "You sold this book and it sucked." Nobody does that. But they would hear. There's always talk. You know, I don't know if you know this, Keith, but people who buy from comic book shops tend to hang around in them and talk comics a lot for hours on end.
That's true, and they
can't get rid of them.
And they develop friendships that can last a lifetime.
And future podcast co-hosts.
That's right. They develop friendships that for technology that doesn't even exist yet.
That's right.
Now, I think Brett's probably got something there. I mean, it certainly I bought hard copies of all the number ones, but most of the books I'll probably wait until they get collected now. You know, Rorschach, I'll probably buy them as they come out. Comedian, I'll buy as they come out, but not necessarily every book. I will end up with trades anyway, so probably it's not worth it for me to buy them. A hard copy set because for resale value, as we all know, my opinion of buying comics for resale value.
Yeah, really. Why buy anything twice? It just doesn't seem worth it. You're going to buy the trades no matter what, pretty much anyway. So why go for it twice?
Trade none.
If you think about it, most people have read Watchmen in the trade paperback. So why wouldn't they be trade waiting on it?
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Good point, Chris. Okay, what else we got here, Keith?
Well, just one last note on the sales. Batman Earth 1 hardcover was the number one trade collection or graphic novel for July. Everything else is pretty much what you would expect, but pretty cool that Batman Earth 1 was the top one there. Now we have the biggest news, which will probably be the most chat we have. We're seeing more creative teams for Marvel now, and some big names, some small names, some interesting ones for these relaunches. Captain America will be Rick Remender and John Romita. Iron Man will be Mark Waid. Oh, sorry. Let me try that again. Hulk will be Mark Waid and Lionel Francis Yu. It was teased as Indestructible was the tagline, but it's actually the Indestructible Hulk. Karen Gillan and Greg Land will be the Invincible Iron Man creative team. Jason Aaron and Esav Ribic will be Thor's new team. And Brian Posehn, Jerry Duggan, and Tony Moore will be the new Deadpool team.
See, now, the Deadpool team I find interesting because of the fact that there was a big, like, Twitter war afterwards because Rob Liefeld came out and said something to the effect of he didn't want D-listers on his character.
I'll just add a nuance to that. Before we get into it, I just want to clarify. That's not what he said.
Okay. Please.
What did he say?
It will also make you angry what he said, Mo. I'm not about to make you unangry.
Don't worry. It's hard to do that.
What he actually said was that the character was so good that he created that it has lasted this long, even though it's always being written and created by D-listers.
Thank you. But the one thing before Mo goes off on his rant, I can see the smoke pouring out of his ears right now. But before he goes off, I thought that what Gail Simone said about it was great because she said that the D-listers in this case were generally hungry creators who always really wanted to bring more to the character. And so they were willing to go further and fight harder for a book. And then the other thing that you missed, or that I don't know if that you noticed, was the Matt Fraction. Did we talk about the Matt Fraction Fantastic Four family one?
No, I did miss that. Yeah, Matt Fraction and Mark Bagley.
Mark Bagley, yeah.
Doing doing the Fantastic Four, and I also missed the team for Future Foundation, which I'll let Mo go while I look up who that is.
It's also Fraction.
Is it also Fraction?
I believe it's also Fraction.
Yeah, because it was tagged as Extended was the for Extended Family was the tagline for the ad.
Not excited, but go, Mo.
Chris, why don't you go?
Well, I guess this is the end of a huge run for me on the Fantastic Four and the FF. Although I've argued Matt Fraction's talents with Mo over several podcasts, I don't think I can fall from a Hickman run to a Matt Fraction run without suffering some sort of pressure sickness. So I guess that's the end of it for me.
So regarding Liefeld, I was going to say people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I'm really trying to. I'm having difficulties. I want to sum up what a jackass this guy is without using profanity.
Actually, sorry, Mo. I do want to bring up that I believe somebody mentioned about that something to the regard of people who live in tin houses shouldn't throw can openers at them. So that's a Twitter thing that I got from another creator, I believe, on the same subject. So it's funny that you bring that
which
up.
Which is sort of stupid too, but it is a good point. Like I'm really trying not to curse here. Really trying hard. It's difficult because I did a show with Joe Mulvey, so I got used to it. But Liefeld, I hate you. That's all I'm gonna say. I can't. I will lose it. So I just can't do anything else.
I will say in his defense, he did later apologize, trying to dig himself out. The exact tweet was, "Testament to Deadpool's appeal and durability is that he thrives regardless of being relegated to D-list talent. Marvel A-list never touches." That's the precise wording. So I'm going to call later as misrepresenting that.
Yeah, no, I may be too forgiving on this. I think he just misspoke in a lot of ways. And if you look at the creative teams that have been on Deadpool since he left, there's not a lot of people that have made a huge jump forward that I can think of off the top of my head.
Hold on. Does any of the three of you, as I try to keep my anger in check, I'm trying so hard. Does any of the three of you really believe that this is some great character and that what people who've come onto that character have done to make him more fun or flesh him out isn't what's made him interesting, but that he was just some great, unique, amazing character that jackass Liefeld made? Anybody?
Anybody? I would say that this is a tremendous character that was built from the ground up and continues to grow from the base that was created by Joe Kelly when he wrote the Deadpool series.
I
enjoyed the character. I liked him in New Mutants. As I've said before, I did collect Rob Liefeld's New Mutants and X-Force. I was a fan of those series. But Deadpool was not a fascinating character in those. He wasn't until Joe Kelly started writing.
You know what? You got me on your side right there.
Yep.
I enjoy those comics. I won't say they're great comics,
but that's definitely fun.
Where he sort of became a violent, crazy Spider-Man character, and that's where I fell in love with him.
Now, this all right. Joe Kelly's Deadpool is, I will say, like Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. The way that Mo and I argued that Mo said that Len Wein's Swamp Thing has nothing to do with everything that's been done to Swamp Thing because of what Alan Moore did. I'll say that about Deadpool.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay.
What was that, Brett? I jumped on it because I was on a roll. What was it, Brett?
Well, I was just going to say, because after reading Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, I was just going to comment that I am a little tired of Deadpool, and I do question why we need to constantly have him going, but,
let me tell you, after reading Deadpool in the Marvel Universe, it makes me realize that if there was a good book with Deadpool, it wasn't because the character is good, it was because the creator was good.
Yeah.
Because Joe Kelly was good, because the character, this was not a good book, so. Alright, let's.
That wasn't Deadpool in that book, that was Wolverine in a costume.
Which is Deadpool, and that's kind of the whole frickin' point.
So to wrap back, the creative team on Future Foundation is Matt Fraction and Mike Allred.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's right. It's Mike Allred. Yeah, I forgot.
Allred. Well, nice.
Damn it. Back on the FF.
And X-Men.
I love Allred.
I know. It's interesting. And funny, he's been away from Marvel for so long, and he just came on to do this one issue of Daredevil. Now on a monthly book. So that's quite a change.
I don't think I've dropped and added a book so quickly in my life.
Yeah, you have. You did it many times when you used up a file with us.
He used to tweet his local comic shop a second time in the same podcast to say, on second thought. And X-Men Legacy by actually two creators I'm not familiar with, Simon Spurrier and Tang Eng Huet. I'm sure I didn't get a single part of that right on art.
Not a single part.
So it's written quite a fast list of these creators coming out ahead of the solicits, which will be top and end of next week, I guess, for Marvel through the solicits. So, what would be the one that's kind of leaping out at each? Chris, certainly the Future Foundation with Allred. That's probably your top one there.
Yeah. Despite the writer, I have to see. I mean, this is one of the most unique teams I've ever seen. And Allred drawing Dragon Man, I kind of need to see that.
Throw me the teams out one more time, and I'll tell you what, and books. I'll tell you what it is that has my interest.
All right, we got Remender and Romita on Captain America. We've got Fraction and Bagley on Fantastic Four. We have Fraction and Allred on Future Foundation. We have the Deadpool team. Brian Posehn, Jerry Duggan, and Tony Moore. We've got the X-Men Legacy team that I'm not going to give a second shot to. And I'm sure that I can't keep seven things in my head at the same time. So I've missed one along the way.
Jason Aaron.
The Greg Land.
Yeah, Hulk, Thor, and Iron Man. The other three books.
Anyways, the Captain America has the most interest in me. Brett, how about you?
Yeah, I would suggest that it does too. Perhaps Mark Waid, because I really liked what he did on Daredevil. But, you know, mostly the Remender.
Yeah, I think I'm curious to see, you know.
We're still waiting for that wow announcement from them, aren't we?
There's no name the size of, you know, what we saw in New 52 with, you know, two books being written by Grant Morrison. There's nothing kind of that size. It is interesting to see Remender with two books of this kind of profile. I mean, I've been a fan of Remender for a while. He's unfortunately leaving Venom to do this.
But he can't read, he can't write 75 books a month like some of the people over at Marvel?
Well, he's doing two very high, Captain America and Uncanny Avengers. Those are incredibly high profile.
And Brubaker hasn't announced anything for Marvel Now yet, has he?
I've not seen his name on anything, which makes me wonder if he's still going to be around.
All right, anything else in the news?
And that's the news.
Excellent. I say this is We Talk Comics number 44. We got it covered this episode because we're going to talk about covers. I mean, we're just talking to Joel Mulvey about what a great cover he had, Scam. That would be on my list of favorite covers. So I'm just going to throw it out that it would be on my list. I'm not going to talk about it because we talked about it on Mojo. But we through that. And then, of course, there's the news about how comic covers are being presented differently through Marvel Comics and the kind of, we had a bit of a discussion on that a little while ago, a couple weeks ago. Then there was those great cover comics, those variant covers that we talked about in the Oxymoron. It just seemed like covers were coming up a lot when we were preparing for the show. So we decided we would talk about our covers a little more in depth. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw to Brett. Brett's going to tell us his favorite covers and what makes a good cover and why these are some of his favorites. And then we'll go from there.
Well, I think that one of the covers that I want to talk about right away is the Fantastic Four number one. It is truly iconic with the heroes battling the Mole Man's big monster. And the main thing about it is that it's so iconic that it's being done over and over again by so many different people, but even more so by John Byrne, who has done that, a version of that different cover, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of like 9 times.
Nice.
And so that's why I want to talk about that. But, and that kind of leads into something else. I love the Marvel Zombies covers because I love the fact that he is referencing all of those books only with zombies. But I also love the fact that he's willing to take it and change it to add...
Who's he, Brett?
Art Sweetum.
Thank you.
To take it and change it to add the perspective, different perspectives and stuff. So I really like what he's done, and it also kind of ties into that Fantastic Four number one. One of my favorite covers is in the X-Men, and I can't quite remember the issue name or issue number, but it's the Welcome to the X-Men, Kitty Pryde, Hope You Survive the Experience. I always remember the text on that. And
143 maybe?
143, yeah. And I just remember it because they've reused that text a million times later on, because it seems like every time there's a new X-Men, it's like, oh, welcome to the X-Men, blah, blah, hope you survive the experience. And so it just really stuck with me, and so I'm going to tie back to the original on that one. I loved the work that Mike Grell did with the Longbow Hunters. I remember like the painted art on those just being amazing, and that is completely what drew me into the Longbow Hunters and in turn Mike Grell's work. And then the last specific cover that I'm going to mention is the Rocketeer trade paperback by Dave Stevens. It is such an incredibly heroic cover. You know, the Rocketeer is in that Rocketeer / Superman style pose. It's got that 50s little circular thing with characters looking up at him. It's amazingly beautiful and just a great cover for that character especially. It really works amazingly well for that character. And then as far as, like, I just even, a few artists as well, like Dave McKeon is an amazing cover artist. He's always got, like, Sandman, you always know it's a Neil Gaiman or Sandman book because it's got a Dave McKeon cover. Adam Hughes, I mean, Lord knows Bill Willingham did a, you know, started up a book just so that he could have Adam Hughes do covers for him. And Bill Sienkiewicz, also another guy you know when he's doing the covers.
Cool. You got Chris and Keith, either one of you got any comments on some of Brett's?
Certainly, I had Fantastic Four number one on my list as well. Such an iconic image. And humorous, because it's not anywhere in the book. I love that, too.
Yeah.
But that scene is nowhere in the book.
That's true.
The old day. You do that now, and people complain that scene wasn't anywhere in there. But, yeah, so great to...
Kirby can get away with those things.
Absolutely. His anatomy was terrible, and he couldn't draw feet. But, you know, everyone still likes him.
Watch yourself. Anything, you have anything to say over there on it, Chris, or you want to move on to yours?
No, I'll just add Marvel Zombies. I believe it's the only cover trade I have in my collection. I don't particularly love when they collect covers, but when the Marvel Zombies came out, right away. And I just enjoy flipping through it, because I recognize the old covers, and just, I love comparing the old cover to the new. Great work.
Yeah, I love the fact that he shows the old, they show the old cover beside the new cover, and he actually talks about like what went into making the new cover. So I think that is a great book.
All right, Chris, okay. Let's do yours.
All right, things that make great covers. A close-up of the Joker. Two of my books on my list both feature the Joker in extreme close-up. Lee, I'm going to butcher the name. Lee
Vermeo.
That is it. his cover for Joker. I probably would have passed his by if I hadn't seen the trade cover of that book of Joker's extreme close-up face. And this one could be just because I love the book itself so much. Joker, Batman the Last Laugh. Just an iconic shot. I mean, you can't not. You know what? I just called it the Last Laugh. I was meaning to say the Killing Joke.
Thank you.
Well, you know, Brian Boland is one of those guys that is very easy to mention as cover artists as well.
Yeah.
The Killing Joke was on my final list when I was paring down my favorite covers. I didn't quite make it. But it's awesome.
Absolutely on my list. Absolutely on my list.
Yeah, and I mean, being as two of the books I immediately thought of when Mo proposed the topic, both feature the Joker in extreme close-up, that's saying something. And I have to say, every time I pass the shelf and they have a close-up of the Joker, nine times out of ten, I'm going to buy that book. I may be a sucker for doing it, but it seems to keep happening. Next, I want to talk about Batwoman, a series that seems entirely devoted to its J.H. Williams III covers. I have never seen a cover for this book that hasn't just made me want to stare and wonder what was in the book. I don't actually feel that the relaunch with the New 52 has been completely successful, but I keep picking up the book just for the covers. And lastly, just for the covers, and no matter how I felt about the book, I've always picked up Hellblazer. You have some iconic runs. I mean, this is a series that introduced Tim Bradstreet. Dave McKean did the covers with Jamie DeLeno. And I have to say, that is one I'd actually consider picking up a trade of just covers. I know I'm not naming specifics here, but there are so many covers that I just fell in love with over the years. But I've given you an overview of what I like and what I buy. Any of those things, right away, those covers get me to pick up the book, so they must be great covers.
Brett, Keith, any comments on those?
I actually had a specific Hellblazer cover in mind, Glenn Fabry. Hellblazer number 61, which was later used as the cover for the Dangerous Habits trade paperback of John Constantine with blood on his shirt and a razor in his hand. I had a poster of it. I had the trade. I had the original. I just love that image.
I believe the movie aped some of that imagery at one point, which sort of does detract, but, I mean, that's just a great image.
Anything from you, Brad?
The one thing that I agree with is the element, like, when you brought it up, Mo, I did have trouble specifically pointing to certain covers because there are so many cover artists that really stand out to me that when I see their work on a book, I instantly turn around and take a look. You know, I'll even go to Sam Keith and stuff like that. I mean, their work is just so striking that I can't help but want to look into it. And so I agree with Chris. If I see those people, I'm probably in and looking at it.
And you know what? The thing is that what is the job of a cover? The job of a cover is to sell the book, right? The job of a cover is if you're walking by and you see that, you go, God, that looks interesting. I've got to know what's inside that. Its job is to, if you already are going to buy it, to make you go, I can't wait till I get home so I can read it. I can't even wait. I'm going to read it on the bus on the way home. That's the job of a cover, right? And if those guys do it and they have a certain style to do it and some guys are better at it than others, then that's awesome.
Well, and I think that's why we see so many cover artists. I mean, it's hard to find a book nowadays that doesn't have, like a mainstream book that doesn't have a cover artist on it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Keith, what else you got on your list there?
All right. Well, I've got Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. Number one, the silhouette of Batman with the lightning bolt behind him. a very simple image, but very, very iconic. And if you saw the recent trailer for Dark Knight Returns animated, they make a point of that image turning up in the trailer. So, really, really strong image. John Byrne's Fantastic Four versus the Gladiator cover, which he has copied probably 20 times on various books from later Fantastic Four, Superman, Superman versus the Legion of Superheroes was one of the first times he copied it, used it on X-Men. He keeps coming back to that image, but it's a really strong image. And, Dave Gibbons, Watchmen number one. It's from the cover, the layout of the cover. I mean, we started this talking about cover layout. Watchmen is not the classic cover layout. And, you know, as Marvel talks about, why is it still laid out this way? There's a 25-year-old book that isn't laid out that way because it was for the direct market and it didn't have to be laid out that way. And I've got a bit of a curveball here. I'm going to put in a cover for a comic that hasn't come out yet, because we've all seen the cover, and this will be one of the top covers of the year. I'm talking about Rorschach by Lee Bermeo.
I knew you were talking about that.
Yeah.
I knew it too.
It might have been telegraphed. This, not only did this image just kill any idea that I was going to make some kind of political stand against buying before Watchmen. But, you know, as I've said, you know, I showed my wife that image, and she's a fan of the Watchmen film. That image was enough for her to go, when's that book come out? And bring it up more than once that she wants to know when that book's coming out. I didn't even show her any internal art, and that's what it's getting. So it's doing its job.
They should make it lenticular. That way his, the mask could change.
It's interesting. It didn't just make you interested in buying the book. It made you interested in buying the entire line. I mean, that's a success.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you're going to see it, that showed me that something they were. This wasn't a half measures. This wasn't getting the B team to throw out some stories. So yeah, that's all right. And after you do yours, Mo, I just want to pop back for a second because I asked this question on Twitter just as we were about to start, and I've got a bunch from our listeners that I'd like to throw up at the end. So you go ahead.
Okay.
And
You'd
like to vomit no up at the end.
No problem. Yeah. Do you guys have any comments, Chris or Brett? Have any comments on Keese there?
Not so much.
Not so much. All right. We're gonna move on to mine then. All right. You know, one of the things you'll notice is I'm not really a big fan of the captions on the books, and that means that that doesn't really work for me. I'm also a big fan of books that are maybe not as iconic, but the images that I remember. I love painted comic books. I can't believe nobody's mentioned anything by Alex Ross, and I'm not going to either, and that blows me away because he's one of the best ever when you talk about those cover ones. I like the Hildebrand brothers as well, and other painted comic covers like that. Preacher number one, for instance, is a great cover, but a book I didn't really read, so I'm not going to use it on there. So I'm going to get into the ones that really do it for me here. And that's Midnight Suns number one. That's a great cover. Just a great cover, great image of Ghost Rider. Again, simple, striking. That is a painted cover. Really gets to me. Superman number 75. I mean, that's what a book's supposed to do. I mean, this book is supposed to let you know what happens. It's supposed to make it feel important without giving away too much. This book is memorable. You won't shake the image from your head ever. Web of Spider-Man number one was a great picture, just a great picture of Spider-Man in the black costume, top of a gargoyle type thing. And then they played off of that by doing another great image, similar image, and they had a style kind of for Web of Spider-Man covers for that first little while. And that was Web of Spider-Man Annual number one. And these people don't think about these ones. These are two of my favorites of all time. You look them up on Google Images. They're great, great covers. Daredevil number 179. Elektra with her, what do you call those, her particular weapon? It's escaping me. Yes, with just spike through Daredevil's mask. Simple image, again, intriguing. I'm going to throw out what I believe is the greatest comic book cover of all time. Amazing Spider-Man number 50. Peter Parker in his street clothes with the Spider-Man face image in the background as he's walking away from it and letting you know that he's giving up being Spider-Man. That is, I have goosebumps just thinking about it. It is the greatest comic book cover, in my opinion, of all time, because I dare anybody who has ever read a Spider-Man book, has heard of Spider-Man, is a regular Spider-Man fan, to pass by that and not go, I gotta see what's happening inside. I gotta know. It creates an emotion immediately for you. It's so good. So that's my all-time favorite. I think the best one ever.
Also covered in Marvel Zombies.
It's a good list, Mo. You dug into the vault for a couple of those, but as you were saying them, that web of Spider-Man, you know, I wasn't interested in Spider-Man, and I picked up that as a single issue because it grabbed me. The Superman 75. You're talking about the bloody S image, are you?
Yep, you bet.
Yeah. That was on my short list actually. There was and the death of Supergirl crisis were the ones that.
Unbelievable cover. Unbelievable cover.
Actually, it's funny because I can actually go back to the zombies element, because when you take a lot of the great Marvel works, they've all been done in the Marvel Zombies, or in Zombies, because I have a print of that Crisis cover done zombie, and also the Spider-Man cover that you were talking about was done zombie as well.
I gotta see that. I missed that.
I just think it's one of those interesting things where when Arthur went in, he took these iconic covers. So I actually could have just flipped through the book and started reading it out, like, oh, this cover right here.
This cover right here.
You know, the Wolverine cover with
covers. We need to see him do some more DC covers. I can think of more. I think Carmen Infantino had a bunch of great covers in the Trial of the Flash storyline and stuff like that. Like the just covers that can tell you what's a continuation of the story. You almost know the story of the Trial of the Flash based just off the covers without picking it up from the inside. What's occurred and what's the twists and turns. I mean, that's awesome to me without a lot of words. So I mean, a great cover. It is different than a splash page, different than regular art. It's something. It's a special art all to itself and deserves its day in the sun. And I think we've given it to it. Anybody have any final thoughts?
It just surprises me that both me and Brett mentioned Marvel Zombies, and I think it boils down to is we love comic book art, and it's a way to replay our best ofs. And I didn't realize that when I picked the title.
Cool. All right, let's time to do some reviews. No,
Keith, you have
some feedback from my Twitter of some friends of the show that.
Oh,
I wanted
excellent.
To throw in theirs. So, Longbox Graveyard.
Thanks
Silver
for remembering,
Surfer,
Brett.
Silver Surfer, Silver Surfer number 3, which is Silver Surfer and Mephisto, is his top pick. Photo Cub says, any cover of Who's Who that was done by Perez, or Justice League, or JLA number 200 wraparound cover.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Perez. It's like, wow, how do you forget
that?
I
guess we need a second category, I think, to do of another time of just the specific artists and the body of work that you get from what artist and, you know, what we talk about.
Hey, who was the artist who did that Wolverine cover where it was almost three-dimensional the way that he did the perspective with the claws popping right out at you?
Trying to think of it. Are you thinking of the Todd McFarlane on Hulk?
Was it the Todd? I think it was the Todd McFarlane Hulk. That was a great cover.
Another one in the zombies. You know, it's just they're all there. It's every one of them. I could just go through the book.
There you go.
All right, we got Mayhem Comics, Amazing Spider-Man 293, which is Kraven dancing on Spider-Man's grave. Ray Wegner, Detective Comics 880, which was a jock cover. It's an image of the Joker made entirely out of bats. That's a really, really strong image. And John M. Lennon, And this is one I can't believe I forgot off the list, because I've even seen the original art for this in a museum. Green Lantern number 85, Speedy shooting heroin.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
The Cartoon Art Museum in San Francisco had that on display the last time I was there. It's an incredible cover.
You know what? One of the odd ones that I actually liked, which I just thought of, is the covers for the 5-issue miniseries, the 198 by, I believe, Juan Doe. And they were really striking. I just, like, a little bit, you know, a little bit off the beaten path, but really just covers that made me want to read the book, even if I had no idea what was going on in the series.
You know, I'm just sitting here while we're doing this and listening. I just typed in the Silver Surfer number 3, looked at that great cover, just looked at the spider, or that reminded myself of that Craven Dancing on the Grave one. I took a look at that. Jeez, these are great. What was the one you mentioned about the Joker and Batman there? I want to take a look at that one.
That is Detective 880.
Detective 880.
880, awesome. Which is it's a jock cover, and it is, it's great.
Awesome. Okay, guys,
Mike Zeck is, you know, as we say that, Craven's last time, Mike Zeck's one of those artists that needs to go on that, you know, who's just a consistently good.
The Punisher Limited Series number 1, just the full bodysuit, one of my favorite covers of all time.
There you go. There you go.
All right. Well, I certainly haven't exhausted this topic.
And friend of the show, Tex, he's done some good covers.
Hey, that Midnight Suns number 1 that I mentioned. That was it.
I need to look that one up, actually. That's one I don't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, it's just awesome picture of Ghost Rider. It's fantastic. All right, let's move on. It's time, though, to move on. Keith, what do you think? Should we do some reviews and...
We're saving you from bad comics.
Here I come to save the day.
All right, Brett, open up with the first WeView.
All right, all righty. I'm going to open up with the first X-Men number 1. The first X-Men can be the first book of the WeViews. Now, this one's by Neil Adams and Christos Gage. It's basically that add-on to the X-Universe in the early days. And I remember back when you brought it up in the news, and you said it really seems like an excuse to just tack something into that part of the universe and part of continuity. And I read it, and that's exactly what I think it is. It feels completely like an excuse to just tack another Wolverine story in to confuse the whole continuity that much more. My biggest problem, though, with this book is not the writing. My biggest problem is definitely the art. Typically, I'm a huge fan of Neil Adams, but I really feel like there's something going wrong with his art. And there's panels that go from page to page where the leaps of logic that you're forced to make because of what the characters are doing are incredibly amazing, and I just can't. I actually had to flip back and forth in the book, and was like, "How did he get from being there to there, in the space of a panel? Wow, that's really it's a jump cut for me." And so, I didn't really like the art very much, and I just felt like the story was pretty good, but I just feel like it's already adding to a really messy continuity, anyways. So a tough sell for me, for sure. Probably wouldn't move on.
This is definitely not Neil Adams' best work. That is for damn sure. This is far from his best work. And you know what, Brett? You really nailed it. I mean, I'm not overly familiar with the X-Men continuity, but from what I do know, this just seems to throw it out of whack and weaken it, and weaken the history and the backstory and the legacy. So I found this to be, it's not a terrible book, but it's really disappointing. I won't read it. Keith, what do you think?
This is as terrible as I kind of was worried it was going to be. I honestly just went back to look at it to see if who was inking him to have made it turn out this badly, but there isn't a credited inker. So I don't know if they went with digital inks or what, but there's some terrible, terrible faces in this, particularly Wolverine, who looks like his teeth are too big for his mouth.
Yeah, the teeth! The teeth are horrible!
It looks like he's wearing the fake plastic teeth. And Sabretooth's not much better. It looks like he's wearing those...
Oh, Sabretooth in that picture of him as a kid? Oh, come on, he looked like he was pretending to dress up as Dracula. It was brutal.
There's some really rough stuff in this book. And as Brett said, I can't figure out how this fits anywhere. The problem you have whenever you add a book like this into an existing continuity that is already really dense is you want to introduce new characters, but you have two problems. Either that character is doomed, why would I bother investing myself? Or you are going to reuse this character into the modern continuity, and there will be no explanation of where they've gone in the 10 years in the middle. So I don't really feel like getting engaged in any of the new characters. That all seem pretty throwaway. They all seem kind of red, the red shirt away team kind of characters that are on this team. And yeah, Wolverine and Professor X hanging out together, and then we're going to have the cliche, I'll wipe his memory at the end of it thing.
Oh God, if that's what they're doing? Oh, you're right, that's what they're doing.
Guaranteed.
Oh my God, awful. I was trying to figure out how they could make that fit. That's the only way, and that's awful.
Wipe his own memory to make it work.
You know what, I wanted to wipe myself actually, with something with this book, and it wasn't a memory.
I hate to be the dissenter here, but I hated the story more than the art.
I don't even know if that's a backhanded compliment.
That's light praise, to say the least.
Terrible book. You guys said it all. Moving along,
Chris. Well, why don't you give us one?
All right. Okay. I'm going to bring up Black Kiss 2. Howard Jakin. First of all, I'm going to review Black Kiss 1, because a lot of our listeners probably haven't... listen to this.
Read
this book.
And it came out when, Chris? In the mid-90s?
Early 90s, I'd say.
Early 90s, okay.
And everybody had this book. And, I mean, in our circle, we passed it around. And we all claim we sort of like it, but it's a terrible book. The big reveal is so incredibly stupid that it doesn't even make sense. And really, it is only there. The book is only good for shock factor. And at the time, it was a big thing to have this much sex in a comic book. Howard Jakin has stated that he was in a very dark period in his personal life, and this was never really meant to compliment or be published publicly. But somebody offered him some money and it got published. And it's there. Moving on to Black Kiss 2. I'd like to say this is more of the same. But, yeah. I mean, it is even worse because, I mean, he's not even in that dark place. It's just him aping bad Howard Jakin. I hated this book.
He's got to be in a dark place. There's no other explanation.
I think he's just trying to shock us again with new stuff. I don't think his heart's in.
Look, if I was to have somebody draw my life as a comic book, I'd want it to be Howard Jakin, because apparently he would give me a huge member for you all to see constantly. I'm pretty sure I read Black Kiss number one and wiped it from my memory. I'd love to do the same with this. This reminds me of a hentai. This is not really so much a comic book. This is more like the Japanese hentai. This is just essentially porn. This is the single most sexually graphic sort of book from a major publisher or a major name type of attached to it that I can recall, probably since From Hell. And even From Hell's sex that was so incredibly graphic at least fit the storyline. It wasn't just for the sake of like, this is really bad stuff. That said, the art is gorgeous. Good Lord, his art is awesome in this. Unfortunately, he's a freaking pervert. I don't know any other way. Howard Jakin is a misogynistic, chauvinistic pervert. And this is a book that kind of just demonstrates that. It's really bad. Brett?
Well, it's funny because when I was looking just going through my Twitter feed, and I was seeing so many people talking about Black Kiss 2, like, oh, Black Kiss 2, Book of the Week, this is the one you've got to pick up and read. And I'm like...
You sure they didn't read Black Hawks?
Well, again, though, for me, like, so obviously there's people out there who like this, but my biggest question is, do they like it because they like it, or do they like it because it's Howard Chaykin and they're supposed to like it? It's just a huge question, but for me, again, you know, I talked before about how Howard Chaykin was one of those guys that I just never get. And you know what? I could never bring myself, despite the fact that Black Kiss 1 was sitting next to me for years when when Keith and I were roommates, and I never once read it, and I haven't read it to this day, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Why didn't you reveal that on the Zero issue, or Zero episode?
Yeah, because I don't think it's a big enough deal. But, you know, the truth is that I have read Black Kiss 2, and I really wish I hadn't. It's just way too many penises.
oh, come on, Brett. Is there ever way too many?
Well, maybe not for you, but...
Keith?
Well, I don't know. It does pass one... It has a sex scene on the second page. It's not sex scene on the first page, but a sex scene on the second page. Penis on the second page. I mean, that passes
every page thereafter.
It's funny. Like, Brett and I talked earlier in the week about what we were going to review on Comicosity, and I said, are you reviewing Black Kiss? And he said, I'm not reviewing. And I'm like, well, what? I feel like one of us should, because it feels like it's supposed to be an important book, but this is the weirdest book I've read in a good long time. I honestly do not know if I hated it. It was so strange that...
It was a hentai.
Yeah, it's not really a narrative, it's not really following anything. There's an extended scene that is a movie that someone's watching, that doesn't seem to be feeding into the plot in any way. It's a wacky thing. I mean, I really do dig the art. This is a lot of penises is a pretty good review. There's a lot of, I think there's,
it's also a lot of incredibly graphic vagina. It's one thing to have a naked woman. It's another thing to have her, I'm trying to find a proper way to put this without being too graphic, but it's another thing to have her genitalia be presented as being inhumanly large just for the sake of showing something like that is inhumanly large. Like, it's like, you know what? This reminded me more, did you ever guys, you know, Penthouse and Playboy, they used to have their cartoons and their bunny. That's what this was. They used to have these cartoons and their and stuff in Playboy and Penthouse. I think Penthouse more so. They were incredibly graphic and having all these sex scenes and whatever. This was more like something like that than a comic book.
Annie Fanny. That's, it does kind of have that feel, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Really does.
I thought that one panel thing was the only tasteful thing in the book, but.
I honestly don't know how to have
the enormous male genitalia, but enormous female genitalia just seems like she has something that needs to be fixed.
I'm the one person that is going to say that I do actually like the original Black Kiss, and wanting more of on that, no pun intended, more along that vein. And yes, I read this and I'm like, I have no idea why this is called Black Kiss. I have no idea what he's trying to do.
If anybody's wondering,
this review is going way too long.
This is a short version of our review, so let's move on to the next one.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, if anybody's looking and wondering whether or not they should pick this up for their kids, just look at the cover.
I'm going to say, actually, before we move on from this, I am going to say, if comic books age recommendations are being graded on a curve, you can now give Catwoman and Red Hood and the Outlaws to your 8-year-old.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because this has changed the grading.
It really has. Archer and Armstrong is what I'm going to talk about from Valiant. I really enjoyed the original Archer and Armstrong, but I didn't read the entire run. I read it sporadically. It was kind of one of those ones I'd pick up in a dollar bin or pick up when it was whatever, you know, and read it. And I always loved every single issue I've read. And I just never had the for some reason, the chance or the opportunity or the desire to go and grab the entire thing. It's been on my wish list to do so at some point in time. So when I picked this up, I was noticed immediately. It's not as quirky. And I mean, the original one is kind of like a quirky, buddy comedy film, action film, you know. This doesn't have the quirkiness. So it took me a little while to get used to the kind of the more straight, presentation, more mainstream, I think, presentation, a little less of the quirkiness. But by the end of the book, I just liked the characters quite a bit. I didn't like, you know, Armstrong in this one. Armstrong's the old guy, right?
Yeah.
I didn't like him as much as I did in the original books, where he's a little more quirky. But they were trying a little too hard with him in this one. But I did enjoy the book. I thought it was fun and a good action book and interesting. And we'll see where they go. They're not really going anywhere new. It doesn't look like from the original, but I think this was a good, like I say, a little more mainstream, a little less quirky, but a fun book, one I certainly enjoyed. I liked the art, I liked the characters and dialogue and the pacing, and I'll probably keep reading it. Brett?
I didn't like the first half of the book, really.
Yeah, I'd say the same.
Yeah, totally. Like, as I was reading it, I was thinking that, you know, wow, this is bad. And then the second half of the book, I kind of caught on to everything that was going on, and I think that I enjoyed that part a little bit more. I think the biggest thing for me that I want to say about this is that so far I'm just really disappointed with the Valiant relaunch. I wish these books were better. The way they're talking about it and the way that the people are coming out for it. I feel like people are just doing it to get tweets. Like people are giving these Valiant books good reviews just because Valiant's going to retweet them.
Oh, they'll do that? Then we got to mention that we give it a good review on the show.
Yeah. And so for me, like, I've just not read anything that says to me, like, wow, now that is a hell of a good comic book. I hope that I will. I want something more out of these, and I hope that I eventually get it. So, you know, but this one's not it.
Chris, your thoughts?
This is the first Valiant book I'm going to actually recommend. I liked this book. I didn't love it. I found myself drifting in and out of it, thinking, that's not the Archer and Armstrong I know. But it was good enough to draw me back in. It defeated all those minor quibbles I had. I'm definitely on for number two. So, positive review. This is a nice, light, quick reading book. Nothing wrong with it. But, you know what? If I forget to buy it on issue 7 or something, I don't think I'm going to miss it.
Keith?
I'm siding with Chris on this one as a recommend. I think this is my favorite of the Valiant books so far. I really enjoyed the take on Archer, the rebuilding this character as the the child of a cult leader, essentially. I thought that was a neat idea, and we didn't see too much of Armstrong yet, but certainly we got a bit of an origin story for him. And I like the same feel for Archer of being the boy who has never been exposed to the big bad world, then suddenly being thrown into Times Square. I really dug that, and I like the dynamic so far. I'd be curious. I'm on for at least probably the first arc, maybe four issues, and see how this develops and see how the relationship between them develops.
Nice. So generally, another good thing I'd like to say about this book, just as a positive, is this book featured a complete and total lack of penises, which I personally thought helped. Brett, you got something there?
Well, I do want to also say that so far, yes, this has also been my favorite book of the Valiant relaunch. I'm just not recommending it.
Again, grading at a curve.
Yeah. Again, grading at a curve, Brett, but grading on the penises to Paige Gerker.
Oh, man.
How many vast vaginas and multi-headed book, penises.
This book is amazing versus that.
Beautiful. Keith, do a book.
All right, well, let's do the big Marvel release of the week. Hawkeye by Fraction and David Aya. Am I doing that right, Brent?
I couldn't tell you. There's so many ways to pronounce that. I would think
let's go with Aya, and then we'll get
later. I agree.
All right.
See now we actually have cards that like that with that name at work, and they are called Aja cards. So it could also be that.
Hey, Brett, didn't the porn star we used to watch named Aja?
I couldn't tell you the pronunciation or how she would pronounce her name. So
come on, that's like the first porn star we saw when we were 18. We turned to video. We're like, who's this hot chick? I think her name's Aja.
I gotta be honest. I know I know I should out of respect for the performers, but I never stay for the credits. So Hawkeye, Matt Fraction. The first thing I'll say is that this is not as clever, goofy as a lot of the Fraction stuff that we've looked at lately. So story wise, I enjoy it more than what I've read so far. It's probably the best Fraction book I've read. The art I was really digging. I like the style, and this book will fit well with the, you know, Daredevil, Punisher, that line of the ground level street level characters. Probably my biggest complaint about this book is somewhere along the line. I don't think it's this book. I know it's come from other places. They've given Hawkeye Bullseye's abilities along the way. He's an excellent bowman. And he's the best in the Marvel Universe with a bow, which is awesome. He's like the Green Arrow of the Marvel Universe, not to say he's a ripoff of Green Arrow. But being incredible with a bow and throwing a penny are two entirely different things that have nothing to do with each other as far as aim goes. And that's something that was Bullseye's shtick. One of my favorite Bullseye stories was an issue of Captain America with the Grunwald Road, where Bullseye used one of his own teeth as a projectile to blind a guard and escape from a prison, and that's why they could never he was never allowed anything physical in his room because anything was a weapon. That's what they've given Hawkeye all of a sudden. It's not an excellent bowman. He has Bullseye's superpowers, and I think that is my number one problem with the book is that I don't really know how he's a street-level character when he does have superpowers at that point. So, I don't know. I'm torn. I did really enjoy the art. I was better on the story than I expected. So, I don't know. Maybe I'll check in a couple of issues maybe try one more issue and see where they're going with this concept of, where the story ends is certainly setting up the new base plot for him and his support and how they're going to introduce supporting characters. But I'll see. I'm hesitant to get a second issue.
Chris, your thoughts?
Hawkeye gets a dog. This is the most generic comic book I think I've ever read. Hawkeye gets in some trouble. Dog saves him. He adopts the dog. Come on. This story has been told 100 times and it's been told better. I think this is a leftover script from something, from another character. This is Iron Fist. That would explain where Hawkeye got all the freaking money. Because Hawkeye's never been a rich character. Stupid comic book, generic, boring. Readable, but boring as hell. We don't need this. It's just garbage.
You know, Chris, and I'm going to surprise you because here's a Matt Fraction book and I really liked it. It probably was maybe my favorite book of the week. I liked it an awful lot, but you know what? Keith has made a point to me that has really resonated. That is Bullseye's powers. And there is also, you say that this would make more sense as a Danny Rand Iron Fist story. And you know what? You're right. I was thinking to myself, I really like the characterization. I really like the I like the pacing and the characters and the dialogue and the straightforwardness of this and not the silliness or the self-awareness. I thought this was a really good book. Man, I really liked it. But you know what? I kept on thinking when I was reading it, this would be better if it was a new character being introduced to me instead of a character like Hawkeye, because it's really inconsistent with how he's being presented both in the past and currently in other parts of the Marvel Universe. A lot of this just doesn't make sense. There's a lot of things that you have to just kind of go, okay, that doesn't make sense, but ignore it because this is good. So that was bothering me. And now you two have brought up something that has kind of also put a bit of a cloud over this. I don't know what to think of anymore of this book. Brett.
The first thing I noticed was the cover. I thought the cover was really good. It struck me. You know, it's another one of those covers. And the interior art, I totally dug. As far as the writing goes, I mean, to me, this was about as exciting as a visit to the laundromat. Great. He's a superhero character that I think he did visit the laundromat in it. It's just that. It's like, ooh, look, let's follow Hawkeye through Hawkeye's day.
I think Laundromat will be issues 3.1 through 3.5.
Yeah.
Truthfully, though, what Brett's saying is not wrong. Again, I think it comes down to it's all a first-person narrative, right? So do you find the character likable and relatable during that first-person narrative, or do you find him boring and slow-paced? I found him likable and relatable, but like I say, now you guys have kind of ruined my... You've ruined my favorite book of the week, you bastard!
Yeah, I totally think it was boring and incredibly slow-paced, and just incredibly... I didn't necessarily have a problem with Hawkeye, I had a problem with every single other character. You know, at the end of the day, wow, if this is Matt Fraction... Then I'm really not excited for Fantastic Four, because I'm not sure what, like, after Hickman, like Chris said, after Hickman, what's Fraction gonna do? He's gonna bring the Fantastic Four, and they're gonna be in therapy for like 20 issues. I mean, exciting? Probably not.
Brett, you're up. Your turn.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump into another book. This one's from Top Cow. I'm gonna do Think Tank. And this one's by Matt Hawkins, who is the, what is he? Is he the, like, editor-in-chief almost of Top Cow? And I forget the artist name, if anybody wants to help or not. But,
Rasan Iqdal. That's my best guess.
All right.
Best guess.
This hasn't been a week for us to know.
We're not doing very well on names.
Can we do nothing but Kurt Busiek books?
Busiek, but
if we can find some books by John Smith, I'd be happy.
Yeah, Peter David is perfect. Yeah,
from John Byron.
Yeah, but Think Tank is
Jim Lee.
The Jim Lee special.
Jim Lee special, yeah.
Jim Lee and Stan Lee. Those two we can handle. All right, Brett, sorry, where are we going? Talk about Think Tank.
Think Tank is by a long shot my favorite book of the week. I thought the writing was really good on this one. I like the character a lot. I think where the storyline is going is really interesting. You know, ultimately, my biggest question about it was, why is this book not in color? It should totally be in color. I this is a Top Cow book that's black and white, and I'm like, dude, I mean, the art's pretty good, and it should be in color. But for me, this was, you know, absolutely my favorite book of the week.
You know, I thought the art started off weak and got better as the book went on. And,
I'll agree with that,
Yeah, it was, and I also really, I mean, essentially what we have here is a character, and you've seen this a million times, who's a super genius slacker, and he's working for this... You know, he's working for the government, creating all these weapons. That's his job. And gets a bit of conscience and no longer wants to work on the machines that kill. The difference, the twist here in this is that instead of leaving then, he continues to work there because basically the toys they give him to play with are so cool that he can't resist it, even though he's just a troublemaker within this universe.
And I think he's too lazy, too.
Yeah, he's too lazy. And that's the twist. So it's like, you expect him to take off and be all, you know, super moral, but he is and he isn't. You know what I mean? So basically, he's just this troublemaker, is what he ends up being. And he's a really likable character, despite, is again, a guy this smart and this lazy, and you wouldn't think so, but you just end up really, really enjoying him. I really like this, too. I thought this was a really good book. I really can't wait to read more. Keith?
I was a bit cooler on this book than you guys. I think the art really put me off. The art is, it looks like kind of a 90s manga book when they just started importing and redubbing the manga books. It's got that kind of look to it. It does improve as the book goes on. I'm not really sure how that's a compliment. I mean, maybe by the end, the artist should have gone back and redrawn the first page or two, if that's the case. I enjoyed the story. It's a little overwritten for me as well. There's a lot of...
Science?
No, there's just a lot of text. There's a lot of... It's text heavy. It is tell instead of show. You know, people are like, there's narration and just overwhelming amounts of chatter. I kind of feel like the same things being done in Manhattan Projects and better for what I'm getting out of this book. So I don't think I'm going to keep reading.
I loved it. I agree with Brett, best book of the week. I can easily, this is straightforward enough that unlike the Manhattan Project, it could be developed into a TV series or something, and that's a TV series I'd like to see. Great book. It's not earth-shattering, but I think this book does everything a number one should do. It sets up the universe. It makes us feel some sort of connection to the characters. I can't wait to see where this is going.
All right, Keith, give us the last book of the week.
All right, the last book of the week is a one-shot. It is, I've forgotten the adjective. It is Peter Parker Spider-Man, number 156.1. And this is the first of a series of one-shots, which we follow by Sensational Spider-Man 33.1 and 33.2, which are part of the 50th anniversary of Spider-Man, which is this year. There'll be an amazing Spider-Man issue coming up soon. And this was my book of the week. You know, we often talk about, you know, jump on points and entry level. This is a book that revels in not being that. This is a book that ties itself in very intentionally to, you know, 10 different comics over the course of Spider-Man's several hundred issues. There's references to issues in the 200s. There's reference to Amazing Fantasy number 15. It's got a great John Romita Jr. cover. And I just really like the idea of spending a little time with these fragments of Spider-Man's past. It's not a period piece. It takes place right now. But it brings in a character that hasn't been seen in a long time. It brings in a location that hasn't been seen in an even longer time. And I'm hoping that the rest of these specials that we see do this same kind of thing. It's like, you know, when DC did the retroactive last year specials that were in continuity stories that took place, you know, up to 30 years ago, that these little nods to the grand history of Spider-Man, you know, most big complaint that New 52 was dropping all that. This is a book that celebrates those fragments from all over the course of Spider-Man's history. I want to see more like this. Celebrating the 50th anniversary.
Chris, kick it.
Yeah. I have to agree with Keith. I didn't love it as much as him. This is a good read. Roger Stern, one of my favorites. I always read Roger Stern when it comes up. There aren't that... He doesn't come up that often, but when he does, it's always a good read. I will say, I think this is a leftover script from 15 years ago. With just some quick backstory or rewriting to make it make sense. Oh, we're going back to the Daily Bugle for just one adventure, just to help out. I think he had this on paper. It was down. Marvel needed something to push out. Here's your one shot. I found that kind of disappointing. I would like to see what Roger Stern could actually do in the modern Marvel Universe.
I'm so glad he wasn't in the modern Marvel Universe. This is my Spider-Man. This is the Spider-Man I want to read. This harkens back to his legendary run of the character. This is the guy who wrote my favorite comic book story of all time, which is a Spider-Man story, The Boy Collecting Spider-Man. And this is just a really good, simple, old-fashioned Spider-Man story. Terrific. Really enjoyed it. And, I think this satisfies new and old fans. Brett, what do you think?
This book made me want to bash my head into the wall. You talk about a simple storyline, and I'm like, this storyline was so simple, I didn't even feel it needed to be told. It was one of those cases where I was reading through it, and I'm like, are you going to do something? Are you going to tell something here that's really interesting to me? Because I don't know. Like,
nice in this day and age when everything is these on-running epic storylines and everything is a shock ending and everything is violence and everything. Then to have something that's just simple, one-off, that you can just enjoy and give to your kids, isn't it nice to have that for once?
You know what? For me right now, it's not. I would never read this book again. This is one of those books that I would absolutely, I picked up, I've read it once, and I've said to myself, wow, I would just throw this book away because there's no point in me ever reading this book because it has no impact on anything ever, period. And it just brings back way too much of the whole idea of like, oh, I'm Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, blah-de-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Thank you, it's been done by Roger Stern many times better. Done.
That's what I liked about it. All right. All right, that's why we do the Wii Views. Brett, give us your plugs.
All right. Well, I am Brett_WeTalk, B-R-E-T-T. I haven't been tweeting much, but maybe I'll get a big surprise there. I'm not like Keith, but maybe eventually I'll get there. Brett@WeTalkPodcast.com. I think that, let's see now, Keith, should I drop the bomb?
Nope.
All right. Good enough. But we've got some.
we are teasing that we're working on an upcoming interview this month, which will be the biggest interview we've had on the podcast yet. But we're not ready to announce it.
That's right.
Just so we've got case great we stuff.
Yes, we have great stuff coming up on the podcast, and so you better.
I have faith
in you
guys.
You better keep going. You better keep listening.
I have faith in you, Chris.
Otherwise, kamikaze reviews.
Go for it, Chris.
Okay, I'm Chris@WeTalkPodcast.com, Chris_WeTalk on Twitter. I do tweet occasionally. If you tweet, I will read it, unlike Brett.
I read it.
I will read it. Oh, no, you don't.
I occasionally respond.
No, you don't. I follow you, man. You never tweet.
I responded ever, to Keith ever. Today.
Other than that, he absolutely did.
Like minutes later.
I have a long lost blog that I'm sure Mo will put up eventually. Other than that, I'm on holidays, so I don't got nothing.
All right, and you can email me, Keith@WeTalkPodcast.com. I love me the Twitter, and I always am ready to talk comics on Twitter. And that is Cub Reporter K is my head.
Hey, didn't you get another tweet on a cover that was great?
Yes, I did, and I'm gonna tag actually just two last ones here. Wisconsin Rob, who said that Astonishing X-Men number 1 with Wolverine's claws is one of his favorites, and Red Bird Brandy, who said Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane 106, and I pulled that one up. That is a really cool cover. It's an issue called I Am Curious Black, and Black in parentheses, and it's actually a three-panel cover, and I can't remember the last time I saw one of those, that is Lois Lane doing like a Black Like Me thing where Superman makes her black for a story, and presumably it'll go undercover. That's a cool, that grabs me. I want to know what that story is about. I want to go find that book.
I want to know how she heard about this book, how she knew about this book.
I think
tweet it out to us.
I'm going to follow up with her after the show, and we'll get some more info on that. So that is a really gripping cover. I like that.
Absolutely.
I believe she has a really rocking website too.
There you go. Of course, there, so everybody does know, of course, we have the best podcast on the net. It's true. It's true. I just said so. It's true. Comic Punk Podcast Network also has some great stuff for you, though, so make sure you check that out. You know, what the hell? I mean, you're listening to us. You're done. You're at the end, obviously. That's where we are. Jesus, go get something else. Other than that, Mo at We Talk Podcast. M-O, We Talk Podcast. Mo underscore We Talk. Really, I don't want to say anything else except for the John Romita Jr. wasn't cover on the Spider-Man. That wasn't that good. M-R-O-U-T.